2014 for adoption by the Joint Rules Committee. The annual political report covers the following aspects: prioritization of the African agenda with regards to the South African Parliament's participation in the SADC PF and the Pan-African Parliament, interparliamentary multilateral relations which include South-South cooperation and South-South and North-South cooperation as manifested by the South African Parliament's engagement in the IPU, the CPA, the ACPEU, the SAEU, parliamentary relations as well as parliamentary bilateral relations. During the period under review, Parliament's international relations successes include, firstly, the prioritization of the African agenda with regards to Parliament's participation in SADC PF and the Pan-African Parliament. Secondly, the process of transforming the SADC PF into a regional parliamentary body is evolving. The 33rd SADC PF plenary session hosted in Tanzania in October 2013 began taking practical steps towards operating like a parliament. Three, FAT hosted the 7th ordinary session in May 2013. Of significance was the seamless election of the new bureau and the smooth transfer of power from the second parliament to the third parliament. Although the Pan-African Parliament works well, we still experience challenges of the attendance of members to the Pan-African Parliament, and the South African Parliament is looking upon to provide leadership to the Pan-African Parliament moving forward towards becoming a fully fledged legislative body on the continent. Further, the report further demonstrates multilateral relations with respect to participation of our Parliament in the IPU, the CPA, the ACPEU, GLOBE, the SA Parliament, and the EU parliamentary relations. Firstly, Parliament has sent election observer missions to Angola, Swaziland, and Zimbabwe. We have found the elections to be free and fair. Number six, we have hosted several official visits and study tours during the period under review, most notably the Speaker of the House of Commons of the United Kingdom, the Vice Speaker of the Palestinian Legislative Council, the Speaker of Japan, the President of the European Parliament, Mr. Schulz, the President of the Storting of the Kingdom of Norway. We have also hosted the Speaker of China. And for the first time in the history of the democratic dispensation, we have entered into a bilateral agreement with the Parliament of Mozambique, our neighbor. All these visits were important to consolidate bilateral relations and cooperation between the Parliament of South Africa and other parliaments with a strong protocol and ceremonial preparation. They presented an opportunity to identify clearly defined areas of cooperation and of engagement. Under observations and recommendations, at the operational level, it has been observed that during this period there was not enough time allocated to parliamentary group of international relations, focus groups, for the purposes of discussing political reports which emanated from various engagements of parliamentary international relations. It was observed that the parliamentary group on international relations was not functioning as it ought to be. Key challenges, among others, are as follows. Parliamentary Group on International Relations has not been functioning optimally because most of the members of the PGIR do not attend scheduled meetings. PGIR meetings always lack quorum. As a result, reports from international engagements cannot be discussed. The focus groups were not meeting regularly as they were supposed to meet and prepare for the various inputs to the PGIR. However, in this regard, before any focus group goes out as a delegation to any other international meeting is very well briefed before they are sent out. The meetings of the PGIR were not planned or programmed well to accommodate the timetables of the NA and the NCOP. There seems to be a lack of dedicated support for the PGIR. Only one official is coordinating the work of the PGIR. We have asked in the restructuring of the International Relations Division that at least three people ought to be working in that unit, in the unit that deals with the PGIR. Thus far, nothing has happened. The 2012 PGIR annual report that was submitted to the Joint Rules Committee for consideration has not yet been discussed because the JRC meeting scheduled for consideration has not been because the JRC meeting scheduled for the 13th of November 2013 had to be cancelled. The PGIR political report for 2013 has been drafted and submitted to the House chairpersons for their considerations and ultimate tabling in the Joint Rules Committee. The absence of the South African delegation in Pan-African Parliament meetings and activities has been extremely high and is unacceptable. Recommendations. It is recommended that concerted efforts should be taken to revise the work of the PGIR in this regard. The following are the proposed solutions, and of course any others from the floor. The chief whips must be encouraged to request their members to attend all PGIR meetings and PGIR focus group meetings. Two, the focus groups should be made up of members from relevant committees. What has been happening in the past is the focus groups were formed and people from trade and industry was put into a group that is dealing with, for instance, climate change. So one needs to be, in this new fifth parliament, this whole structure has to be re-looked at. And the members that are au fait with the issues must be put into those focus groups so we can have an informed focus group that goes out to represent South Africa. The PGIR, there must be at least two alternate members of the PGIR meetings and focus groups. The PGIR members who are not attending the meeting should not be allowed to attend international conferences. All PGIR meetings must form part of the parliamentary program and avoid the clashing dates of the programs of the NA and NCOP. And then again, the process of employing three officials to support the PGIR must be expedited by the Secretary to Parliament. The House Chairperson is in the process of consulting with the Chief Whips and the House Chairperson for committees in order to improve the functioning of the PGIR. Dedicated support to the PGIR by filling positions of the PGIR Committee Secretary, PGIR Committee Assistant, and PGIR Training Liaison Coordinator. The filling of these positions will ensure smooth coordination and organization of the PGIR activities through the IRP division. To fulfill Parliament's Africa agenda, the fifth Parliament ought to design a clear strategy that ensures the active participation of its members in the affairs of this continental Parliament, that is a Pan-African Parliament. In other words, I think our Parliament should have stronger relations with the Pan-African Parliament. They are having problems, and I think they need, it is our baby, I think that we need to give further support for the functioning of the Pan-African Parliament. In conclusion, the Parliament Strategic Plan of 2009 and 2014 has prioritized the need to improve and widen the role of Parliament in international relations cooperation and participation by developing and implementing an international relations strategy as one of its core objectives. Parliament in its nature is an embodiment of democracy. The policy perspectives and operational guidelines for Parliament's involvement and engagement in international relations as agreed by the Joint Rules Committee 2006 noted that the participation of the South African Parliament in international relations is informed by the national foreign policy. The South African foreign policy is an expression of domestic public policy that projects the democratic values of our country. These values are entrenched in the provisions of the 1996 Constitution of the Republic of South Africa. The Constitution affirms the rights of the South African society to live in human dignity, equality, democracy, and freedom. Moreover, Parliament's strategic plan states that Parliament is committed to all the values and principles embedded in the Constitution, which is considered to be the foundation of establishing a society based on democratic values, social justice, and fundamental human rights. Close quote. Furthermore, our Parliament's international engagement supports and reflects South Africa's national imperatives, which include critical issues such as democracy, job creation, education, health, poverty eradication, and economic development. Lastly but not least, parliamentary international relations could be seen as a continuation of a national political process and dialogue among legislatures at international level that has been brought about by significant changes in the world. At different international meetings, members of parliament and presiding officers have the opportunity to exchange views and adopt resolutions on a range of international issues and challenges. The PGR tabled the 2013-2014 annual report for adoption to the Joint Rules Committee.
Thank you, House Chairperson, Mr. Chais. There is a SIG report that has been tabled to you last time. I'm sure people were able to go through the report. Mr. Judge was giving a synopsis of that. Open for discussion. Ms. Kubai, and then followed by... Ms. Kubai, continue.
Thanks, Jefferson. Indeed, we received the report. I think we need to commend the tabling of the report and welcome the submission. But just a couple of issues I want to raise. Firstly, just to highlight that the structure of the report makes it a bit difficult to read, and if it was possible so that it's reflected properly. And it might even be difficult to reflect because the headings themselves. But I'll start with the executive summary. Where I feel that there's a part where it speaks about where under the annual report, I'm trying to find the pages, page 4, that summary at the introduction should be on the executive summary because it needs to highlight what PGIR stands for and where it derives its mandate. And surely it should be within the executive summary that you come into first. And within the executive summary, Chair, I feel that there's points where we've gone into detail where it should go into the item areas. An example is on page 3, where already in detail the report discusses issues in IPU, which could have gone in where the part where it details the work that has been achieved by IPU. So my understanding is that the executive summary must give us the contrast of the report, the rationale of our participation in international events bodies, and what we are hoping to achieve with the report itself. Not go into events, but then subsequent to that, when you go to itemize parts, wait the annual report of the Parliamentary International Relations 2012 and go into detail, for example, at point where you say starting to speak on static issues. This is what we hoped to achieve. This is what we have been able to achieve. Its relevance and how we've been able to make meaningful contribution to that particular body. So I think that that's what I'm reflecting to how the report has been structured, and it becomes a bit of a challenge. But again, the other issue that I want to speak to is Mahajaj reflects it on her summary. But when you go to the report, there isn't where you speak about the focus group of IPU, focus group like the work that is being done by SAEU. Because beyond the international participation in engagement, there's work that is being done, processing of issues and processing of work before we can go there. And the report does not acknowledge that part, does not reflect it. The other area that I don't find being reflected, for example, when it comes to IPU, the contribution in terms of engagement prior to even attendance of each assembly, through debates, through engagements, is not reflected. And that is linked to how do we translate to the work and participation in international forums to our own policy in terms of achievements, which was not reflected. Towards the end of the report, it goes to talk about observations. More is critical analysis, but does not reflect on achievements. This is what we set ourselves to achieve, and this is what we have achieved. Clearly outlining that we've not done what normally speakers say, people going on touring, but impact-driven in terms of the reflection of the report. I thought as you go to the conclusion, rather than going into the issue of speaking about what the strategic plan, the conclusion speaks about what we hoped to achieve, which I think should be at the beginning of the report, and at the end, the conclusion should be able to say to us, set out the programs and the achievement and the strategic plan, this is we have been able to achieve what we have set ourselves to. So I thought, let me just highlight that in a broad term and not go into detail, but I think there's more work that needs to be done in structuring the report and reflecting that we've been able to achieve what we needed to. And remove some of the finer detail, for example, in the report, it reflects about our stance in supporting a female person in the IPU to be Secretary General. I think it's a detail that shouldn't be in the report as an annual report, but to go into our objective of our participation in IPU, what we seek to achieve, and if we have been able to achieve that, because I think we have done quite a lot of work in terms of IPU. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ram Kubai. Tuchigalani.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Let me also echo my commendation of the report, which captures the work that has been done, but it's just a pity that it does not capture what was done before. I'll focus on recommendations in particular, because I'm sure that's where it's mainly important. My expectation is that it would have been quite helpful to have made reference or brought a recommendation of BRICS, because our engagements from an executive level with the BRICS, within the BRICS partnership, has intensified, as we have seen in the Durban summit recently. And surely the legislature expectedly should reciprocate, if not advance and complement, the good work that has been done by heads of state. Secondly, I see focus on focus groups. I thought it would have been helpful also to raise a recommendation on how to set up an advanced friendship society as well, according to the policy perspectives and the operation guidelines that was adopted in 2006. Chair, can I just add two recommendations here? The first one is we should ensure PGI that PGIR has a dynamic engagement with DIRCO, because as it is referred here that the operations of Parliament are anchored around South Africa's foreign policy, so that that strategic engagement with DIRCO, whether it's through the parliamentary committee, would be very, very helpful. Another area is training, which should be extended beyond the members of the PGIRs, such that the rest of the members are also aware about international issues. Lastly, I trust this would form part of a legacy report. It's just to emphasize that, because the expectations are that the PGIR of the Fifth Parliament would definitely be more active than the current. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honourable Chairman. Ms. Schaefer, I'm not sure whether I'm pronouncing it correctly.
Not bad, thank you. Schaefer, that's right. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. There's just a few queries. On page 3, the point, second bullet point, about the Secretary General being replaced by a woman. I was part of that delegation, and I don't recall any discussion about a woman. We were discussing all the way along that we would be supporting the guy who's currently the deputy to take over. And I don't recall a woman. The discussions that I was part of certainly didn't say a woman. So I'm not sure if I missed other discussions that happened, perhaps, but I would like that clarify. Certainly, I think it is certainly a very comprehensive and interesting report, but I think what we could also benefit from is perhaps some more information on the bilaterals that happened in, for example, at the IPU. I was fortunate to be part of one with Syria, and it was extremely interesting, so that might also be useful for future purposes. And then just on page 11, the paragraph 36, there's no mention of the minority dissension regarding the Zimbabwe elections. I know the DA representative specifically refused to sign the SADC report, as did 14 other delegates, and I would like to see that reflected also in the report. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Ms. Gillian? Oh, Kylan. I'm sorry. They've written Kylan.
Thank you. I agree with Ms. Kobai that the report is not ordered in a way that you can follow, you know. It's a good report, it's a comprehensive report. With regard to the challenges, while the focus group, I'm just trying to find the challenges so that I could talk to it. While the first point I agree with that PGIR is not functioning optimally because members of the PGIR do not attend meetings, I also want to say that due to the high vacancy rate and the slow restructuring of the PGIR, it has also not been able to function optimally. And I don't see that reflected here. Although we are saying that we want 3 officials to support the PGIR, I would like to see the point that the restructuring and the filling of vacancies has also been slow. And if that is expedited, then perhaps the PGIR could achieve what it's supposed to achieve.
Ms. Fox?
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Well, first of all, I must thank Honourable Hajjaj for the comprehensive report in a number of ways. But one does take on board some of the points that has already been alluded to here. One of the things which I think in the challenges that we may properly reflect on in the report is the need for a clearly identified policy for the parliamentary international relations, the cooperation here. What is our policy? And clearly spell this out. Secondly, a structural restructuring of the composition per se could assist, I believe, in overcoming some of the challenges that exist, you know, scheduling of meetings, etc. But in the first instance, it will be policy and its objectives that would drive that attendance, one would want to believe. The other thing is there needs to be a clarification at some point here in the leadership of the parliamentary institution as to what do we mean by a delegation of parliament? What are the obligations of that delegation of parliament? Who is it they are representing? Are they representing parliament of the Republic of South Africa? Or are we representing the different groupings here? And I think that's never been clearly spelled out. And there is a need for that to be done in the next term. I really would like to say that so that people are not walking in different directions. And that may also, again, address the technical problem which is impacting on a policy of attendance at Parliament. The other issue is, you know, if there were quarterly reports, this is I'm part of one of these focus groups, and I think I found it difficult to digest all of it at once. And therefore, a more quarterly reporting mechanism, I believe, would be very helpful. I would also like the report to notice under the recommendations that if you can't meet, you cannot get decisions into the House. There is a process. So it may look after 5 years that you've only done two things because it has not been adopted by the House. And I think that that would be an important plank in the process going forward. But I do want to thank Honourable Hajeja. I've worked under her. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Fox. I think there has been enough input on that. I also want to say thank you for the wonderful job you have done in putting up the report. Under the PAP, perhaps what you would like to consider, not just addressing the question of absence there that needs to look at, but also as a host country, what have we done in order to support the parliament itself? I think you could add that question as well. But I agree with you also with the attendance, we need to look into that. At times there are a lot of clashes between the sitting of the parliament here and the parliament of the Pan-African parliament. Like next week is sitting and all members will be here for the pieces of legislation and committees, and we want to rise for elections and so on. And you've got to look at other countries as well. You can't just look at the South African parliament only. But those are issues that we need to attend to. But I think to move away forward, I will give you a way to respond. I think once Mr. Jaich has responded, what we need to do, let's note the report, because there are other issues that need to be included in the report, and the matters arising from it will then be added in the legacy items of the fifth parliament. That would be my suggestion, how to deal with the report. But we take it, it's done a wonderful job. We know now what are the issues that we need to address in the fifth parliament. Mr. Judge, or Speaker, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Chair. Just a small point, follow up on the point you made about support for the Pan-African Parliament. We are, of course, hosting the Pan-African Parliament. But most important, it's also hosted by Gauteng. And I don't know what relationship exists between the provincial legislature of Gauteng and the PAP. I don't even know if any of them visit the PAP, which is down the corner. So clearly there has to be some kind of mechanism where the provincial legislature where PAP is located must interact with the PAP in as much as we have to interact as a parliament and as a country. So perhaps the delegation to the PAP might want to interact with the Gauteng provincial legislature on this issue. Thanks.
Thank you, Speaker. Honourable Judge.
I'm on point two, since the 10th anniversary of the Pan-African Parliament. And I think it has been significant if we could send a delegation to celebrate with the Pan-African Parliament from our national parliament, and of course Gauteng. Unfortunately, Gauteng from day one has really never interacted with the Pan-African Parliament. So it is a problem. But I think it's not only only our attendance. When you look at, you know, when you go into that hall, it's a problem of the whole Pan-African Parliament, the absenteeism. And the fact that they arrive in South Africa and then they disappear, they don't come to the meeting. So I don't know whether at some stage we need to write a letter as host country to the AU, because it is an organ of the AU. Because something has to be done. We extend it down the line. We need to move forward.
Thank you very much, Mr. Josh. Can we then agree that all other matters raised will be then raised as a legacy issues for the Fifth Parliament, so that you correct all the wrongs?
I'm still concerned that our Zimbabwe minority view gets incorporated in the report if we're going to accept it like this. It can't be resolved in the legacy, as a legacy issue.
What should be in the report?
The view that not everybody from the delegations or the observer mission to Zimbabwe agreed with the SADC report.
Is that fine, Mr. Judge? You will look into that. Okay. Thank you very much. The report is noted. We now move to...
Chairperson, sorry.
Yes.
Excuse me. What is Mrs. Honorable Hajaj is supposed to look at? Incorporating the report. Is that what you...
Yes.
No. I thought there was a question that we need to address ourselves to in the Fifth Parliament. A question that is saying, are we going as parties in the delegation when we go to these observer missions, or are we going as parliament? Until you answer that question, we're not able to incorporate the report.
All right. Let me take a hand from the Chief Whip. Chief Whip, let's work to close in the matter.
Please, Chairperson, because I thought you made a ruling when you said we noted the report.
Yes.
So everything else falls off.
All right. The report noted, and let's move on forward with item 6. Report by the Joint Whips Forum. Attendance policy for members of Parliament.
Honourable
Clazo. Oh, not Honourable. Mr. Clazo.
Thank you, sir. I am presenting the draft attendance policy, which has been agreed to by the Joint Whips Forum. The document has been circulated. Can I just check first if we all have copies of the draft attendance policy? Okay. May I proceed, sir? Right. The first section of the report or the draft policy deals with definitions, just to indicate that these definitions have, as far as possible, been drafted in line with those contained in the rules of Parliament, NA and NCOP rules, and that legal services made inputs into the draft policy, mainly on the issue of leave categories, but also on the issue of definitions. So these have been vetted legally. So with your permission, I will speak to the draft. I will not go through it word for word. Then in terms of the rationale for the policy, members would be aware that the Constitution in Section 47 and in Section 62 provides that a person ceases to be a member if that person is absent without permission in circumstances for which the rules and orders prescribe loss of membership. And in the National Assembly, Rule 20 provides that if a member is absent for 15 or more consecutive sitting days on which the House or such a forum sits, the member must obtain the leave of the House. It, however, does not provide for loss of membership or punitive measures if such approval is not sought or granted. And in terms of the NCOP, Rule 17 of the Council provides that a person ceases to be a permanent delegate if that person is voluntarily and without leave absent from the Council for 15 or more consecutive sitting days. And a permanent delegate seeking leave to be absent from the Council must apply for leave from the Council. So that really one provides the basis for this policy, the legal basis, and basis in terms of the rules. But also the Remuneration of Public Office Bearers Act provides that payment of salaries and allowances of members is subject to the rules and orders of the National Assembly and the National Councils of Provinces. I think it's important to make the point that as a general principle, political parties must ensure that Parliament is able to function but by taking decisions when required to, and that their members are present at committee, forum, or fora, and plenary meetings. And failure to do so may result in sanctions being imposed on the offending members. However, this is the point that the Whips Forum made. A collective decision by a political party to break quorum by withholding their participation at such meetings at this point in time, that is excluded in this policy. As I indicated earlier, there is a legal basis for the policy to be in place, and that it is accepted that political parties are responsible for managing members' leave, and that absence from parliamentary work should be controlled by the political party. In the NCOP, the policy also seeks to affirm the role of the chief whip of the council in approving or rejecting a leave application by a member. In terms of the purpose of the policy, it provides minimum standards for attendance as indicated, and it also seeks to provide a consistent and equitable basis for application of leave for members in both houses. It provides guidelines for sanction for unauthorized absence, and it also provides a mechanism for recourse for grievances in respect of application of the policy. If we may now go to the section that deals with the scope, the policy that is on mine is page 6, but is paragraph 4, scope of application. The policy applies to members of the Assembly and members of the Council. It does not apply to special delegates. It also does not apply to members of the Executive. Also, in the event that there is a conflict between this policy and the rules of the respective houses, the rules of the houses will apply. Then the document goes on to define categories of leave. These, you have family responsibility leave, details of which are provided in the document, compassionate leave, maternity leave, parental or adoption leave, spousal leave, political party business leave, private business leave, study leave, cultural or religious leave, sick leave, special leave, and special leave. As indicated, these were also vetted from a legal point of view, but also the forum, the Joint Whips Forum, had extensive discussions on these categories of leave and other aspects of the policy. Then in terms of the procedure for granting leave, the applications for leave must be approved by the whip of the designated political party. In the case of the council,
After obtaining approval from his or her political party, a member must also inform the relevant provincial whip and the chief whip of the council, who will, where applicable, based on the work of the council, consult with a member of his or her political party in order to approve or reject the leave. The council, the chief of the council is the one who approves or rejects the leave after these consultations have happened. And that if a member is absent beyond 15 days, the relevant house must be approached in order to authorize the extended leave of the member, authorize or not authorize the extended leave of the member. Now, we now then get to sanctions in respect of absence. The forum is proposing, joint with forum, that if a member is absent for 15 or more consecutive days of the assembly or council without the leave of the house, the member loses his or her seat in the council or in the assembly. And if a member is absent for three consecutive meetings of a committee to which he or she is appointed as a full member, not as an alternate member, outside of the sanctioned absence agreed to by the member's political party, a sanction may be applied to the member by either the assembly or the council to the effect of R1,000 for each day of absence. We were asked by the Joint Whips Forum to check this matter with legal services, whether there is in fact a basis for monetary sanctions. We have done that, and the opinion is that provided that provision is made in the rules for this sanction. Otherwise, the Act, the Remuneration of Public Office Bearers Act, on its own, may not be applicable in this instance. But if this aspect is then incorporated in the rules, it is possible to apply monetary sanctions. In essence, if this position is approved, it means the rules must be adjusted accordingly so that they can provide for monetary sanctions. So the proposal from the WIPS, Joint WIPS, is that R1,000 for each day of absence must be applicable. In the case of the council, this is in respect of committee meetings. But in respect of the House, 15 days of absence consecutively without authorization, you lose membership. But if you exceed 15 days, then the House must pronounce itself on your absence. So the House can either agree to extend your absence, or if you are authorized for the 15 days, beyond 15 days, then the House must get involved. Sorry, that's the point I wanted to make. But if you are not authorized, then you lose membership, or you lose your seat. Thank you. The point that was made was that in the case of the council, if a member is absent during a three-line leave without being on authorized leave in terms of this policy, sanctions may be applied to the member by the council. And also that this policy does not replace any procedures established by any of the houses to be followed in the investigation and determination of allegations of misconduct or contempt of parliament. I think with the approval of the chairpersons of the Joint Whips Forum and the members, I think this section that has been underlined maybe does not apply anymore, just the one that says that this requires further political input. Maybe they may wish to say if there's a wish to extend the scope of the sanction, perhaps the fifth parliament should consider that, but I'm subject to correction on that. Then the next section deals with recording of leave, and that all political parties must keep proper records of the leave of their members. However, it is the responsibility of the concerned member of political party to inform the chairperson of a committee or duty whip of their absence in a committee meeting or sitting of the House. In the event of sanctions in respect of absence, document must be submitted to the administration, and that the relevant tables must also be given documentation, and that attendance record of members should be published annually by Parliament in the announcement, tabling, and committee reports document. And in the NCOP, we would like to read this into the record. The chief whip of the council keeps the record of leave in the National Council of Provinces. And Speaker, the next section, and Chairperson, the next section deals with recourse where there are grievances, that a member who feels aggrieved by the sanction imposed may lodge a formal appeal to the Speaker or the Council, as the case may be. If the presiding officers are unable to resolve the appeal, then the matter may be referred to a committee, either an existing committee or a committee to be established for the purposes of this leave, of this policy, to consider instances where a member of political parties are aggrieved by the sanction. The committee should then report its findings to the House, to the relevant House, in terms of this. And that in the assembly, each party and in the council, the chief whip of the council must ensure that this policy, once agreed, is communicated to all members on the day of its signing, or at least days after a member is sworn in as a member. I think the point to make, if this policy is adopted today, it would mean that the joint rules may have to be reviewed so that they can make provision for what is contained in the policy. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Ms. Bulena. Honorable members, that's the draft policy in terms of attendance. I'm sure you have had an extensive discussion in the joint Chief Whips Forum. Can I see some hands to adopt the document, Mr. Koranov?
Chairperson, thank you very much. Can I just ask one question? I think I'm the only one here representing a smaller party. But sometimes it means that you serve on 6, 7, 8 committees as a fixed member. And then it is theoretically possible that you can miss 3 consecutive meetings where you are appointed as a full member while you're attending the other meeting. So I think there must be somewhere a provision, maybe the onus on me, to prove that I was in another committee. That's why I've missed 3 other committees consecutively. But I don't want to be penalized for that. So I don't know. Maybe if the Secretary can just mark it somewhere and to protect those members.
But the report of the other committee will indicate the register that you were present. It covers that. So you will not be treated as having been absent. Mr. Khan?
One small question, Chair, and that is that I see in sub 10 on page 4, there is reference being made to a sanction that may be imposed on an offending party if they do not do their duty in terms of attending and so on. But then if you go to the section dealing with sanctions being 9, and you look at page 9, then you will see there is no provision there specifically for the kind of sanction that can be imposed on a political party.
Can you just refer us to the page, Mr. Gunn, so that we are with you?
Yes, the first one is sub 10 on page 4.
Page 4.
And then if you go to page 9, then,
yeah,
then you would see under section 9 or clause 9, you would see the sanctions for members, but there is no specific reference to what kind of sanction can be imposed on a political party. That is just my question, why that is so.
Okay. Well, let me take a few questions. Masbu will just jot them down and we'll come back to them. Deputy Speaker?
Thank you, Chairperson. It's just a clarification on page 4 that item 10.2, the exclusion. Where it's saying, however, collective decision by political party, something that happened yesterday is excluded here. Is there an explanation for that? And then 2 on page 7, 9, there's under cultural and religious leave 2 days. Is it an assumption that, you know, some now I'm thinking of a situation where my son is going for initiation, I don't need 2 days, I need a week or 2. isn't that considered like other leave? And I don't know what's the justification for 2 days. And then the question of 15 or 30 days leave without absence, is the rationale, because it's taken from the practice that we have? Isn't a month's calendar? I'm just thinking of somebody who went to a trip. Somebody went to a trip and not able within 2 weeks to ask for a leave. Now, maybe you can explain if the leave means I'm asking for a leave from my party and my party understand the circumstances and then on my behalf ask Parliament for a leave. So what I'm questioning is 15 days versus 30 days. Isn't 15 days too short?
Okay. Can I take Ms. Schaffer?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I just have a concern regarding the fact that the House needs to approve leave more than 15 days in the following sense. And that's something we've experienced in one of our municipalities where there's conflict between two political parties. And that is where the House can make a decision in favour of members that they favour, and it can make a decision against people they do not favour. So if it's somebody comes along that you really don't like and they need extra leave, the House can just say no, sorry. And other people, they can just say yes. So I would like some kind of perhaps consideration of putting that if the House refuses to leave, then they must give reasons. So at least that could be challenged if necessary.
Let me take the other three questions and then allow answers. We'll then take it forward from there again. Mr. Williams.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. In connection with the members in the NCOP and the termination of the membership in the NCOP when they are more than 15 days absent. The members of the NCOP, they are appointed by the provincial legislatures. Is it legal that the NCOP can decide to terminate that member in the NCOP, or must they send a recommendation to the provincial legislature with the reasons and the request that that member must be replaced in the NCOP?
Mustafa, Honourable Fats.
Yes, thank you, Honourable Chairperson. It's point 10 here, where there is one principle laid down very clearly, a general principle, that political parties, chief whip, etc., would have an obligation to ensure that members are present in committee, at a forum, etc. Now, the thing is, you already have the ruling about the 15-day issue, 15 working days, 15 committee days, saying that's it, that's the top-up. But the issue then is when political parties extend it beyond the 15 days on written request, and I didn't clearly find out where that would not be allowed, or you'd have to take it forward. So your political party wants you to go and do something, whatever that is, and you get permission to remain out of the committee. I think some parties have adopted a practical approach by providing alternatives who aren't alternatives. But when full-time people are required to be there, and I think it doesn't make that differentiation, if you're full-time, going away for 30 days could be quite detrimental to the, if you like, the constitutional multi-party principle we have implemented in our committees. And I think that that is very important. The other issue is one does understand that the absence could be politically motivated and therefore one may wish to justify that. But in terms of all the leaves, etc. here, there was one called parental or adoption leave. Now, a number of
communities or cultures, if you like, inverted commas, adopt children, if I may put it that way, and not actually legally adopting them. And I don't know if we've taken account of that context, which does prevail in our country. Thank you.
Mr. Gama, I saw your hand up again.
I just wanted to ask another question, and that is, why a definition of absence hasn't been considered? Because you have all these categories of leave, and then if you would say that absence basically, you know, excludes when you are on leave for these particular reasons, then it could have made it easier. Has that been considered to put in a definition of absence? Because at the moment, as it stands, is even if you have leave in more than these categories and it exceeds 15 days, then you have to have a special resolution by the House. And if it would have excluded these categories as defined, then obviously you wouldn't need so many special resolutions, perhaps. Thanks.
Mr. Flynn?
Thanks, Chair. After the 15 days you lose your seat, then there is provision made for a mechanism for appeal, but it's silent on saying, if you lose your seat, how do you appeal? Or in the interim, do you still keep your seat waiting for the appeal process to finish? I don't know if it can be dealt with in the policy, or maybe there would be rules to be put in place for that. And the other one is, I'm speaking to what Honourable Gum was saying, there would be no reason to put in leave for anything less than 15 days. So all those different categories are good to have, but if you're not going to have any punitive measures put against you, why have them in the first place?
Ms. Kailan, I will now close questions. You are the last one. Then I'll ask people who have to respond to a few questions to do so.
My query is around the legal opinion and sanctions. My understanding is that the legal opinion says you cannot have the sanctions until you change the rules. And currently the rules are under review, but I don't think that that's going to happen in this parliament. How would we accommodate the issue of a fixed amount for sanctions in the current policy?
Chief Whip, did you want to respond or ask a question? After Ms. Willel, okay.
Okay. May I?
Yes, please.
Thank you. I think the point on Mr. Kornoff, the point is that the sanctions becomes applicable only when your absence is not authorized. So if you happen to be absent from a meeting and that was authorized by your whip, then the sanction is not applicable. So the onus would be on the member to inform the relevant structure. I think that should be the case. I will be assisted on this offending party. I think the policy at this point in time deals with offending members, so that word may just have been there by mistake, but I've got my colleague here, Secretary of the Other House, who will also assist me and the chairs of the Joint Whips Forum. So it should be offending member. The sanctions at this point in time are not applicable to parties, but to the offending member. Because remember, the member would not have obtained, presumably, would not have obtained permission from their party for being absent, because the sanctions are applicable only in instances of unauthorized absence, either by the party or by the House. So the punishment, or rather the sanction, should be applicable to the offending person, the offending member. I think on the issue of breaking the quorum, I will defer that to the Honourable Chairpersons of the Joint Whips Forum. They could respond to that. But also to the issue of 15 days is 15 consecutive sitting days
15 consecutive sitting days, then the sanction becomes applicable. There was a debate, ma'am, because the NA, I think the rules said 30 days, and the NCOP said 15 days. And there was a debate within the forum, and ultimately the view was that 15 days is long enough of unauthorized absence. Because in that 15, and consecutively, 15 days consecutively, if you are absent, you don't inform your party, you're not authorized by your party for 15 consecutive sittings, then there should be something wrong, and that the sanction must be applicable after 15 days. So that was the stance within the Joint News Forum, but I think the point is made. Ms. Schaefer raised the issue of House involvement. I don't think maybe I'm qualified to respond to that, but I think you got the point, ma'am, that with beyond 15 days, the House gets involved. Beyond 15 days of absence, the House gets involved. Up to 15 days, it's the party that manages that. But beyond 15 days, the party must then report to the House, and the House must pronounce itself on your absence. My colleague from the NCOP will respond on the question by Mr. de Villiers. Then why not define absence? The policy seeks to define attendance, and we can check if it is necessary or possible to define absence. But there is a definition for attendance, that attendance refers to the presence of a member at a plenary, extended public committee, sectoral parliament, a meeting of a parliamentary committee, or a recognized parliamentary forum, or an approved oversight activity, that is attendance. So it extends beyond the House. It also goes to committees, but it also extends to issues like your international fora, IPU, CPA, and ACEPU, and others. If you attend there and your attendance is authorized, then you cannot be punished for your absence in other activities. I think the issue of appeal, I would like to consider that, and maybe my colleague would also comment. On sanctions, I think, ma'am, the point of the legal opinion is that the sanctions, that particular sanction, will have to be operationalized by the rules. So the policy can be agreed to, but to operationalize the monetary sanction, you then need to have the rules in place. But that does not prevent this policy from being agreed to by this committee. And to say that those issues that necessitate the rules will not be operationalized until the rules are in place. Thank you. Advocate Pinella, do you want to comment?
Advocate Pinella.
Thank you, Chair. Unfortunately, Honorable de Villiers is not here, but the provisions and the rules of the National Council of Provinces is consistent with Section 62, Subsection 4E of the Constitution, and is therefore perfectly constitutional. I think that's the only question that was directed to me, that I was requested to respond to. And I must say, Honorable Gum, that absence perhaps is a converse of attendance, or the other name for attendance.
Yes, Masum. The issue of personal leave, let me raise the issue, is 2 days enough? Maybe one should consider that you also have what is called special leave, which is not limited to a particular type of leave. So if any of these days would prove to be insufficient, my view is that you could then invoke the special leave category, where you would then motivate why you need to be absent beyond 2 days. Then the special leave category could become applicable. Thank you.
Chief Whip? I'll start by dealing with the last part. The understanding of the committee is that we are united in our diversity, therefore your religious leave, your special leave covers everything that we can think of, as long as you have authority to take it. This policy only sets parameters for the rules to apply. And that is why we brought it here, because we want the rules with this policy to to work together with the rules, not to be contrary to the rules. Many people think that the rights are just given for people to take without taking responsibility for exercising the rights. That is why we suggest that they be incorporated. The second issue is the issue of the breaking of the quorum. This matter is an international practice. It's not only because it's exercised by the DA here in Parliament, and because we think that they are spoilers, but it's accepted. What we have warned the DA, and they understand this, and we think that the rules must cater for it, is that there will be rogue parties coming to this Parliament. And the members of the opposition sometimes forget that. And the rogue parties will deliberately make the parliament ungovernable and abuse this rule. So whilst it is right to use it, it may also be abused. So you think that the DA is responsible, but there may be a conglomeration of rogue parties bent on destroying the credibility of this institution. So there has to be some parameters so that the discretion is given in the rules to the presiding officers to govern the abuse of that exercise, however the exercise is a legitimate exercise. The issue about the definitions, I think Honorable Paso is correct. The definition of absence is the converse of definition of attendance, except that it may be difficult in the policy to insert what is the minimum standard of each. We think that perhaps the rules must provide for the minimum standard and give that discretion to the presiding officers as well. Because the difficulty is, we know as a fact that members come to the House 2 hours before the sitting adjourns, or 2 hours after the sitting has been decided on, and they sign the form and leave. So that's not attendance. It's really abuse of your responsibility. Now we think, therefore, that this must be given to the presiding officers to rule on it, otherwise the attendance definition is correct. I think that that's okay.
Honorable Mtagana.
I accept the view that has been expressed, that is a democratic right here all over in democratic parliament. But the point that I think we should consider, maybe dealing with it in the rules, is that the party that calls for division cannot walk out after calling for division. I got no problem about it, because that is an organized walkout. But you can't call a division and walk out at the same time. I think that's what that we should really look at it in the rules. But in terms of the policy on leave, I think it's fine. We can accept the policy on leave. But the rules must deal with this issue, because I think it's the most unfair and democratic way. You call for division, you walk out at the same time, despite the fact that Parliament allows you to vote yes or no. And there will be no apparent reason on that. I have heard that they do that in many other parliaments. But also if we take other many other parliaments without also domesticating their views to our own situation, I think we are going to cause more problems. That's the point that I think we must really consider on that. They involve over years those parliaments, their cultural way of working and tradition. It suits that. You may find it very difficult for us to take that cultural tradition of our parliament well. At a democratic level, I thought that it is more democratic for a person to say yes or no, or abstain. An organized walkout, I don't think, is an appropriate way of expressing your democratic right as a member of parliament. Of course, I'm saying those who call for division, they must sit down until the end of that vote. I think that is more fair to do so. But I think it's a separate issue, Chair. It's not for the leave of absence. is another matter that we must discuss separately from this one.
Okay, the rules can deal with that. In other words, simply what you are saying, you cannot call a division and walk out. You've got to be there to vote for that division. That's a separate issue. It can be dealt with separately, not with together with the leave. Maybe we can discuss it later on. Mr. Waters?
Chair, since the issue has been raised about members walking out from the division's calls, I mean, maybe we should also look in the rules that the governing party, whoever that may be, is responsible for the quorum in the House. They have an obligation to ensure their members are there. Just for your information, yesterday, I mean, hundreds of the governing party MPs weren't there or thereabouts. And the fact is, if you have a party, and I know we're the official opposition, but we only have 16.75% of the votes in the House. And if a small opposition party can actually block legislation, as temporary as it may be, then I think maybe the governing party needs to look at themselves and ask where their members actually are. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Gunn, I want us to round off the discussion.
Just a very small question, Chair. On page 9,
page 9.
You would see that sub 2 and sub 3 refers to unauthorized or authorized leave, unauthorized absence, and so on. Shouldn't sub 1 then say, you know, also refer to unauthorized absence? Because at the moment it only refers to absence. Just a question. Because that could solve the problem to a large extent.
Okay. Ms. Wilene?
I was going to say it will be adjusted. I think it's a drafting issue. It will be adjusted.
Okay, my feeling is that there's consensus, sufficient consensus on this document. Chief,
Honourable Chair, the policy has been adopted by the parties. We brought it here not for the policy to be voted on. We brought it here because it has to comply with the rules.
So that's why I'm saying the way I hear there's sufficient consensus. So the document is fine. It can go for the rules to be redrafted and comply with the rules in Parliament.
Just raise a point about including reasons by the House if they refuse to accept the 15 days. If they refuse to approve the 15 days, now what's happening to that situation?
I don't know who can respond to that one. The question is, say you bring the request for an extension of a leave in the House and the House refuses. How do you deal with the matter?
You lose your position. Because there will always be a reason. There's no House that will be, what is the term? Unreasonable. If you say no, there will be a reason for saying no. And that is why sometimes the parties are covering up for the person. Take the example of the one person party. The person is absent, is not present, has not submitted an apology, there's no reason for being away. After 15 days, they come here and say, we want to be condoled that I was absent. When there was absolutely nothing indicating where you are, how can the House accept that?
So, Chair, can I follow up?
Honourable Wurato?
Can I just follow up?
Okay, Ms. Schaeffer, follow up first.
We're not saying that shouldn't happen. We're just saying that in order to make sure that there is no abuse, the Chief Whip agreed that there must be reasons. So all we're asking that we put in the policy that if the House says no, they must give reasons. If they're good reasons, that's fine.
Ms. Wurato?
No, Chair, I just wanted to say that we also have a recourse for all these grievances so a person can have the chance to appeal and all.
Okay, thank you very much. The document is adopted. Thank you very much. The matter is closed. Let's move with our agenda. Item 7. Joint Standing Committee on Intelligence. Honourable Frolic.
Thank you, Chairperson. Honourable members will be aware that at the last meeting of the Joint Rules Committee, it was agreed to that a report be received on the matter that is in front of us. It was also agreed to that the presiding officers would facilitate a meeting with the chairperson of the JSAI. The speaker requested me to have that meeting with the chairperson, and I have duly done so and reported back to the speaker. The outcome thereof is also contained in the report that has been distributed. I just, for the sake of the seriousness of this matter, chairperson, would just like to briefly go through the report and what the report from the joint committee says. It's under the heading Outstanding Annual Reports, the Joint Standing Committee on Intelligence, period they're reporting on is 2010, 2011, 2011, 2012, and 2012-2013. The introduction. The tabling in Parliament of the annual reports of the JSAI has been an ongoing concern of both the committee and the presiding officers. As far back as 2010, in a letter dated 22 April 2010, the Honourable Speaker had expressed concern regarding the late annual reports of the JSCI. The committee responded in a letter dated 19 May 2010. Since then, numerous letters have been received from the Office of the Speaker and the House Chairperson, Honourable Frolic, on the same matter. All correspondences received from the House Chairperson and or the Honourable Speaker has been responded to either in writing or the Chairperson of the JSAI met with the Honourable Speaker or the House Chairperson to discuss the matter where explanations were given. It is significant to note that since the formation of the committee and the enactment of the Intelligence Services Oversight Act No. 40 of 1994, the annual reports of the committee has always been late. The fundamental reasons are set out herein below. The committee met on Wednesday, 26 February 2014, where a letter received from the Honourable Frolic was tabled and discussed. The letter from the House Chairperson is dated 18 February 2014. The Chairperson of the committee was instructed to address a letter to the House Chairperson with the response of the committee. The committee's letter is dated 3 March 2014 and has been delivered. Status of outstanding annual reports. On Tuesday, the 4th of March 2014, the committee was notified that the annual reports for the periods 2010-2011 and 2011-2012 do not compromise national security, and these reports will be tabled in Parliament today, Wednesday, the 5th of March 2014. The annual report for the period 2012-2013 is still under consideration by the relevant ministers. This matter is being monitored on a day-to-day basis to ensure that this report is tabled before Parliament rises. The chairperson has undertaken to keep the Honourable Frolic informed in this regard. The non-compliance of the JSCI and annual reports. The compilation of the annual report of the JSCI together with its final presentation for tabling in Parliament is a complex matter. It is therefore not possible in this report to set out in detail all matters that affect the tabling of the annual report of the JSCI. We do, nevertheless, with respect, draw your attention to the following. Chapter 5 of the Public Finance Management Act, Section 3 of the Intelligence Services Oversight Act, No. 40 of 1994, as well as Section 3B of the same Act. Then also reference is made to Section 3A, with the relevant subsection of the same Act, and the provisions of the Public Audit Act, No. 25 of 2004, specifically Chapter 3 and Section 15, Subsection 3 and Section 22. The aforementioned statutory provisions are inter alia a few of the impediments that affect the finalization of the annual report. In this regard, it should be noted that the time period set out in the Oversight Act, that is now the Intelligence Oversight Act for the JSAI to report, is within two months of the 31st of March, is not in harmony with the PFMA, resulting in a statutory incongruity. Moreover, the material and information which form the subject matter of the annual report of the JSCI are classified. The process of declassification of this information does not lie within the jurisdiction of the committee and is time-consuming. In order to comply with Section 6, Subsection 3 of Act 40 of 1994, the JSCI has adopted a procedure. This procedure has been followed since the inception of the committee. The procedure is followed in order to comply with national security matters, after which the report is tabled in Parliament. The committee also has had additional challenges. There's a shortage of staff, where the office manager resigned almost 2 years ago and has not been replaced. And also there's a further staff member that has left and has not been replaced yet. Furthermore, the chairperson of the JSAI during this period to chair two further ad hoc committees. Accordingly, as a consequence of practical and statutory considerations, the annual reports of the JSAI have traditionally always been delayed and the tabling has always been late. In this case, other matters have affected the tabling. The committee will now recommend that the necessary amendments be effected to the Oversight Act now that the restructuring of the State Security Agency has been completed. Thank you, Honourable Chairperson.
What does that mean? Does it mean we will not get the report before we rise for this term of Parliament?
As the report indicates, Honourable Chairperson, two of the reports, 2010-2011 and the 2011-2012, has been tabled this morning. I've checked and that is the case. It should be published tomorrow.
Okay.
And then the last report, 2012-2013, that was completed on the 27th of February, last week, by the committee, will be tabled before Parliament rises next week.
Okay. So the reports will be tabled. Okay, thank you very much. That's the report. We're happy about that. The reports will be there at least. Okay. Thank you very much. We move. Mr. Landers?
We need to be careful when we say, are we happy? We're not happy.
Okay.
So.
You know, but the reports will be there.
Please qualify that. We're not happy.
Okay.
We note that the reports will be.
Okay. Tables. We note that the reports will be tabled. I'm not happy. Ms. Jefferson?
We're also not happy at all, but I would just like to pick up on Honorable Landers' suggestion last time when he said he used to serve on this committee. I mean, the reasons given here are for, you know, hardly any reasons anyway, but the ones that are given are pathetic, quite frankly. But he suggested last time that when the reports come, the JSCI gives the relevant ministers a certain time period within which to deal with them. And if they aren't back at the committee within that time period, they then reserve the right to table those reports. And I would like to suggest that we adopt that as a rules committee, that we adopt that procedure, because I suspect then that the declassification and all the other security issues will be done a lot quicker.
Okay. That will be noted. Thank you very much. Item 8, Marina.
No, Chairperson. Just in response to that, may I say that just this morning I had a discussion with the legal advisor in the office of the Speaker where we're looking at this matter. That is just one element of possible amendments that we are referring to and that Mr. Burgess is referring to himself in the last paragraph of the report. So that is a matter including the issue of the time frames given to the executive to report that will be attended to, and at the appropriate time we will take it back to the relevant committee for parties' input. But we can't agree here to an amendment.
Item 8, Marina.
Okay, good afternoon, Honourable Members. I'm just quickly going to go through this report. Members will have it before them. It was circulated. And it's just a number of 10 legacy issues that we picked up. Sorry, that I put a drama voice, so I should know how to use this. Just a number of 10 issues which we picked up on, which have not been completed by us, still outstanding, and we might want to pass them on to the JRC of the 5th Parliament.
Can you just talk to them, Marina, not necessarily?
Yes, I'll just quickly. The first two issues go together. The one is the membership of the Joint Planning Committee on Defence and the mandate of the Joint Planning Committee on Defence. Now, both these issues were before the Joint Subcom on review of joint rules, but as we know, that Subcom, we had an absence of a chair for the NA component for a while, and then we had the motion of no confidence. So basically, that is an issue that needs to be dealt with by them. And I would say that the first one is quite urgent, and is something which will have to be attended to right at the start of the 5th Parliament, because in this Parliament, the Joint Standing Committee on Defence was required to have 37 members, which we all know we battle with portfolio committees which have 12 or 13 members. So to get 37 members together is just unwieldy and impractical. And so that issue, I think we can perhaps ask that be resolved right at the start of the 5th Parliament. And then the mandate, we know there's a lot of overlap between the mandate of the Joint Standing Committee on Defence and the House committees that deal with oversight issues. So that can also be looked at and the mandates clarified so that we don't have so much of an overlap. The Joint Standing Committee on Defence actually itself has submitted a report which can be considered by the Joint Subcommittee. The third is a report, a mandate of the Constitutional Review Committee. There was a comprehensive report published on the ATC by the CRC, and they've asked for certain changes and rule changes that they suggest, and changes, so we suggested that be handed over for discussion also to the Fifth Parliament. The fourth issue is the language policy of Parliament. Now, that came to us via the POA because it involves core business, and apparently there was a discussion about the language of Hansard and the publication of Hansard in English only. So maybe there's a requirement for an update of the language policy, particularly given some of the language bills that were adopted by Parliament recently. The fifth is the public participation model that we already decided last week. The JRC decided that it will be handed over, so it's part of the list. Then we have the Interim Joint Committee on Scrutiny of Delegated Legislation. Now, as members know, at the moment we have an interim mechanism for that. It's an interim body. So the Fifth Parliament needs to decide, does it want to, and it exists by House resolution, not in terms of the rules yet. So the Fifth Parliament needs to decide, do they want to make this a permanent kind of mechanism, or do they want to look at something, do it in a different way? And in both cases, we know that that committee has submitted draft operational guidelines. Now, whether we want to keep it permanent or keep it as an interim body, in both cases, we'll look at the draft operating guidelines to assist with the working of that particular mechanism. We all know that the National Assembly adopted the Financial Administration of Parliament Act, Asker Amendment Bill. I'm not quite sure whether Interpia has done that yet. Not yet. But that provides for an oversight mechanism, which we will have to have a look at. That's also part of the JRC's work. The Money Bills Amendment Procedure and Related Matters Act, that the amendment of that particular act or possible amendments were referred to the Finance Committee by on the instruction of the JRC, by the House, the NA, and we had the last time we had a progress report on that was mid-2012, so we need to take that matter up again in the Fifth Parliament. Then there was also a comprehensive number 9. There was a comprehensive report by the PC on international relations and cooperation on Parliament's role in treaty making processes. Now, that is something that we haven't looked at yet. It was referred to the JRC, so I think that is another issue that needs to, we need to start looking at possibly. And because it's a joint matter, it needs to come to the JRC. The last one just flows out of Mr. Jaija's report, and it will be added issues, obviously. Parliament's international relations policy, I think we last adopted that in 2007, if I remember correctly. And maybe it's now 3, 4, 7 years down the line. Maybe it's time to just, in line of the issues raised in Mr. Jaija's report, maybe just have a look at the international relations policy as well.
So, on the very first point, Standing Committee on Defense, just to, for the record, to state that we are aware that the NCOP holds a different view in terms of this legal opinion. The view is that you need a constitutional amendment to change the membership of the Joint Standing Committee on Defense. But that's a matter that the Joint Subcommittee must consider. I just thought I should put that into the record. And the last one, that we have now adopted, or this committee has now adopted the attendance policy, it would mean that rules would be needed to give effect to certain aspects of the attendance policy, especially the matter of sanctions, monetary sanctions. Thanks. And that could be a legacy issue.
Okay, honorable members, these are legacy issues that will go to the Fifth Parliament anyway. But it's quite true. If you look at the membership of the Joint Standing Committee on Defense, it's a matter of statute. It's established by the Constitution. There is no way you can change it by means of rules. You've got to amend the Constitution. Maybe we need to get a legal opinion on that, just to make sure whether we're moving in the right direction. But it's not for discussion today. These are matters for noting for the next Parliament to deal with. I want to suggest that you go to item 10. Do you all agree? Thank you very much. The meeting is closed.
Thank you.